Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So Jake, Dynamite ends with a back and forth verbal confrontation between Hangman Page and Swerve Strickland. Heated words back and forth, and then a challenge accepted. Tony Khan booked it. Next week, Hangman Page and Swerve Strickland battling it out. The idea being that the winner probably moves on to get a title shot against Samoa Joe, unless they turn it into a three-way. Samoa Joe at ringside for the main event match, featuring Swerve Strickland beating Rob Van Dam. It was intense. And then we've got another match added to next week's show. As Zach Cadorn mentioned on Twitter X a moment ago, the first real big Dynamite of the new year with the tag titles and the men's world singles title on the line. What'd you think of the closing segment?
I thought it was well executed. I think, you know, Hangman and Swerve have shown that they have good chemistry, you know, on the microphone with each other. And that was on display there. They went out of their way to have Hangman, you know, point out that even though Swerve holds two important victories over Hangman, that, you know, it's always come because of the Mogul Embassy and their involvement. And so I don't know if that was an attempt to set up maybe they're going to be adding a stipulation between now and next week that they'll be banned from ringside or how they're going to go about that. But my gut still tells me that we're going to end up with a three-way here.
Yeah, my gut tells me that too. What do you think of the dynamic with Swerve and Hangman in terms of the leaning heel and face, the crowd responses to both of them, where you think they're going, where you think they should go? Are they going to be in sync with crowd reactions?
I want to say that it's probably better for them to kind of part ways in different directions. I think Hangman could be an effective heel, and it's not something that he's explored a lot in his time in AEW. And I think Swerve, just, you know, crowds just seem to want to cheer the guy, despite the fact that he, you know, he did some really scummy things, you know, particularly in that feud with Hangman Page. And so whether you, I mean, you probably can't turn him outright babyface. That wouldn't really be believable, but certainly like an anti-hero role would probably suit him just fine. But they probably do need to do their best to follow the crowd reactions. I don't think you can keep both of these guys in their current alignments, particularly if they're going to have, you know, if Swerve and Joe is the plan, let's say, and you have Hangman lose another match clean next week to Swerve to finally, you know, put their feud to bed and say that, okay, you know, Swerve is clearly the better man, at least at this point in time. You have to have Hangman, you know, take on some different personality traits as a result of that. You know, how does a guy who is, you know, as prideful as he is, handle a situation like that? So I think they have to make some big, you know, swings with these characters, because I struggle to really get too excited about a lot of AEW stories these days, because a lot of the show feels very predictable, and, you know, a lot of the major story beats you can see coming from a long ways away, and I don't want to have that impression over the long term. So make some big changes, shake things up. Let's see what these guys can do.
Yeah, you mentioned Swerve can't go babyface, but maybe an anti-hero. Do we need to broaden, for the sake of the vernacular, broaden the vernacular for the sake of discussion and categorizing wrestlers as being able to be an anti-hero and a babyface at the same time, in the sense that I think some people think babyface means smiling, never using any underhanded tactic or fighting fire with fire, and losing your edge and just talking about, you know, take your vitamins and eat your vegetables. And with Swerve, I think, to me, Swerve being a babyface is simply he's largely exclusively booked against heels. He does not do anything to stop the fans from cheering him overtly, to reject the fans. But it doesn't mean he has to do what MJF started doing, which is, you know, you're my peeps, you're my people. Let's have a corny catchphrase that y'all say. When I say one thing, you say this. Like, of course, that's corny, and that wouldn't be good for Swerve. But I almost think, like, the landing place for Swerve, and I would argue, I'd advocate for this quickly, is to be a babyface in the broad sense of the term, where the announcers are not talking about him cheating or being despicable. He's not invading anybody's homes anymore and threatening babies. And you just go with a flow of, like you said, not fighting the fans, cheering him and liking him. But then the complication is sort of Hangman's in a similar spot. Samojo's in a similar spot. Samojo's kind of an anti-hero who fans cheer. Hangman now has more of an edge to him. So in the end, I mean, I think Swerve's going to be a face in a broader sense of the term without dramatically changing who he is, but shifting things a little. Hangman seems like he's going to go, he'll join the Bucks. And then Joe is the one that I'm less sure about once he gets past Hangman and Swerve, because I think they could go either direction with him in terms of going, all right, he's a champion who takes on all comers and you can cheer him or boo him. That's fine. I don't think that approach elicits the most passionate crowd responses when Joe's going from one match against the heel to another against the babyface and you just cheer or boo him contextually. But that might be what they think is best for him at this point. So as I talk, I mean, I'm kind of portraying, I just think AEW has some choices to make, not necessarily going down the path I said, but eventually I don't think you can just have a world champion and your two top challengers sort of be ambiguous in a pick'em situation. Because I think it will lead to some ambivalence on the parts of fans or people choosing sides in a way that undercuts the others in what they're going for in this situation. So my hunch is everything kind of lands in a certain spot once we get past Revolution and once at least one of those wrestlers, if not two of them, move on to other things. Your thoughts, Jake?
Yeah, I don't think, you know, certainly Samoa Joe, you know, and Swerve might, you know, fit into this same category, and I guess Adam, you know, even Adam Page's journey certainly hasn't been a straight line, you know, throughout his time in AEW. So they don't fit into your, you know, prototypical or archetypal definitions of what is a babyface, what is a heel, you know, those types of things. I think have gotten increasingly less relevant as wrestling storytelling has attempted to get more complicated. But you know, I still think it's important to frame your characters in a clear way so that your audience isn't left confused by their actions on a week-to-week basis. And I think MJF suffered the most from that in AEW over the last 6 to 8 months. And, you know, Adam Cole, to a degree, I think suffered from that. And I think they have an opportunity here with – you know, I guess all three of these guys to really darken the lines between them, create some separation. There shouldn't be a feeling of homogeneity where all three guys feel like they could be going in either direction. So, you know, whatever they decide to do, you know, next week and at Revolution, whether they're going to keep the title on Joe, whether they're going to crown Swerve, you know, whatever the case may be, coming out of it, you should have a very clear idea of who these three guys are and what their identities are going to be going forward. I think eliminating ambiguity should be the goal here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as we have seen in wrestling historically, especially the way AEW promotes it, which isn't a radical break. It's not UWFI or Pancrase. I mean, it's basically a variation of WWE, WCW, TNA, ROH. Fans want to get behind wrestlers enthusiastically, and they also enjoy having wrestlers that they want to boo and relish seeing lose and get what they've got coming. And at some point, you got to kind of pick a side if you want that peak level crowd reaction. That doesn't mean steering fans in a patronizing way or an old-fashioned, staid, outdated way. You can have complex characters that are layered, but ultimately there's got to be something. You want fans to have, like you say, a reason to feel a certain way about someone, and that does come from wrestlers having a constitution that guides them. Are they willing to constantly have a manager distract the referee or their opponent to give them an advantage? Well, I mean, I don't think fans are ultimately going to cheer for that. because they want to see people fight for themselves and win without a crutch or help. And so if there's going to be cheating consistently by any of the three we're talking about, I don't think you can then also expect to get the best reaction for them if you're also hoping for them to be baby faces. And that's where it just comes down to. I think we're going to see a moment, maybe next week, where there's a sharp indication of who Hangman Page is today and who Swerve is today. How they react to whatever the other does, I think will define them. And but then you in the three-way situation, if they do a triple threat, then yeah, you have the complication of how does Joe fit in, and is Joe siphoning off some cheers from, let's say, Swerve, if Swerve goes babyface in a three-way situation, or do you just go one-on-one with both of them and have the matches at separate times, which they could also do. Do you, by the way, do you think there's a right way to go in terms of the World Championship at Revolution? Would you like to, like by May, we'll just stretch it out even past Revolution. Would you vote for Joe being champ, Swerve being champ, Hangman being champ, or someone else by then?
I guess it probably, you have to think about where you want to be in September when they're back in Wembley. And I'm assuming that the plan is to have MJF back, by that point, and perhaps, you know, being back in contention for a title, you know, that he lost, you know, ostensibly because his best friend betrayed him and, he came into the match with banged up and all those things. And so, I mean, who do you ultimately want to have, MJF facing if your goal is to have him back in a position to challenge for a title at that show? And I'm assuming they want that to be Adam Cole. And so it would feel like a weird place to crown Swerve, say, at Revolution, if he's then going to hold the title for a few months and then hand it over to whoever is going to be MJF's challenger at Wembley. So if that's not the ultimate goal, if you want to go with MJF Swerve, that's possible. But I mean, I'm guessing that Samoa Joe is going to retain until Adam Cole is healthy enough to take the title from him. That would be my guess right now.
And I'm not saying anything you said is wrong, but my vote would be for MJF and Cole to feud without the world title and go a different direction with the world title.
I think that's fair. I guess I'm just trying to think what your biggest match is. And I guess that seems to be the longest running story that they have yet to pay off. But if you're right, and then Swerve's opponent, you know, if he's the champion, could be any number of people by the time they get down to September.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think you can kind of get a two for one. You can establish a world champion early this year. And by the time you get to Wembley, August 25th, you end up with MJF and Adam Cole in a grudge match. Although that storyline, I mean, as a parenthetical sidebar here, has been so botched in the sense that no one's bothered to ask any questions or explain in detail or even in a cursory way, when did the con begin by Adam Cole? You know, at what point in the timeline did he go from sincerely being MJF's friend to not, or did he ever? And for that to not even be talked about makes me think they don't think they can tell a coherent story, so they're just moving on. And part of me is just like dreading MJF coming back and trying to make sense of it. And maybe they won't. Maybe MJF can come back and just beat up Cole. He'll be a face and Cole will be a heel, and they won't ever explain it. But, man, that's a long way to wait to expect fans to get invested in a storyline where they were left without a resolution at the end. At least I don't think it was a satisfying resolution. They put, you know, three, four mid-card guys together and put Cole in a wheelchair and said, okay, now that's our payoff. Ask no more questions. So I don't even know if it's a hot enough storyline to revisit. I mean, they probably should, but part of me is still frustrated with it. I'd say blow it off on an episode of Collision and let everyone move on. But I'm overreacting perhaps a bit in saying that. Okay, we got a lot more to talk about. Let's pause and introduce ourselves and introduce the show. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, January 31st, 2024. And I am Wade Keller, host of the show, and we are here talking AEW Dynamite. The other voice you hear so far on the show is Jake Barnett from ProWrestling.net. Jake, welcome back to the co-host chair, and I can still say it because it's January and we haven't talked yet. Happy New Year.
Thanks for having me, Wade. It's always a pleasure.
Yep. This might be the last time I get to say it, you know, until like next January. So there you are. Cool. Well, let's give out the phone number and the email and move forward here with our show. The number, if you want to join us live, is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. If you'd like to join us, call that number and push 1. That'll flag you on the switchboard so we know you want to be on the show. I'd love to hear what you think about the choice AW has in terms of the face heel dynamic and with Joe Swerve and Hangman and who you'd like to see be world champion come April and May once we kind of get past Swerve, Hangman, and Joe in this you know, kind of three-way situation that they've set up. And we can also talk about the tag team title match and everything else from tonight's show. Including Jake, people joking about people smoking pot before their wrestling match, and everyone just chuckling about it, and the silly mystery of RVD that was sort of tongue in cheek, but also kind of a weird approach to take. You can also email us wadekellerpodcast@gmail.com, wadekellerpodcast@gmail.com. All right, Jake. First, a broad question before we go to first caller. Did you like tonight's show, in or dislike it, and why?
I thought it was better than last week's show. You know, just in terms of pacing, and you know, there were some, you know, some backstage segments and vignettes that aired that I think helped boost next week's show, which feels like the first big Dynamite of 2024 in a lot of ways. But I think it did suffer a bit because pretty much every match on the show kind of felt like you already knew what was going to happen ahead of time. And a lot of the matches with stars, whether it was, you know, Paige or Strickland in those matches, or, you know, even, you know, like obviously the Wardlow match and, you know, the women's match, you just like, it feels like there's a lot of the same type of encounters happening in AEW where, you know, you have a match with an inevitable outcome and yet it still feels like it drags on way too long. And I think a lot of times that frames AEW stars as being a little too competitive with people that have been sort of defined to the mid card, and it might, you know, limit the perception of their star power to a more casual audience, you know. And so I think for those reasons, it felt kind of like a middle of the road show to me. I didn't hate it or anything like that, but I wasn't really wowed by it when it was over.
Yeah, I think the if you're going to come out of a show thinking about like two main things, and that's one of the boxes you want to check, where you don't throw so much at everybody that nothing stands out. I think what we got were two strong things. We got Hangman Page and Swerve next week on Dynamite at the end, and then the brewing Young Bucks versus Darby and Sting feud, but a sit-down segment with Ricky Starks and Big Bell interacting with Sting and Darby, and that's the other standout aspect of the show. It had the binder of Hangman picking Swerve's opponent, Swerve picking Hangman's opponent, and then sort of a bit of a dream match, I guess, with Jon Moxley and Jeff Hardy, a first-time novelty match. And then, you know, the obligatory women's segment, and then a little bit with Chris Jericho and the Callis family setting up the Takeshita match also next week. So I think this was structured well. It was enjoyable. You know, good mix of action and talking segments. So I just think format-wise, execution-wise, solid show. I middle of the road is fine because I don't think middle of the road for AEW means a show that isn't enjoyable. But, yeah, I don't think it jumps off the page as top shelf or you know, a sign of AEW with all their faults on display and no, nothing redeeming. So in that sense, yeah, I think it's a middle third show, but probably on the higher end of the middle third for me in terms of where they are, what they're working with, and the direction they're going, and setting up next week's show. And certainly they're setting up Dynamite more than they are Collision. Collision is not that lineup they announced of two matches is not hot-shotting. By the way, did they announce when the rankings are coming, or how the rankings are going to be coming out? Because I don't think they've ever
been. They already dropped them on Twitter. So they're already out there.
I've been hitting refresh. But I guess I didn't. So, oh, there they are. Yep. Okay. Yeah, I guess I didn't in the last 5 minutes. So there they are. Cool. So that gives us something else to talk about, and we'll do that. They have Swerve Strickland, number one, Hangman Page, number two, Adam Copeland, number three, John Moxley, four, and Roderick Strong, five. That's interesting. And they've got four champions. They got four men singles champions. It's a very good graphic, by the way. And then five contenders for the four singles titles. So we can get more into the tag team. The men's tag team, men's trails, and women's title rankings as we continue on with the show. So, all right. With all that said, let's go to our first caller, and that'll be Larry in Beardstown, Illinois. Larry, welcome to the show. Good to hear from you again. What's on your mind tonight?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. First, do you guys think that anyone is enjoying what they're doing or having more fun than what Toni Storm is doing with what she's doing right now?
Jake, what do you think? What's your latest on the Toni Storm gimmick?
I think I really enjoy her performances. Like she delivers very strong individual performances, and you're right, you know, Larry, that she appears to be having an absolute blast doing it. But everything that she does, I don't know that it's improved by her being the Women's World Champion. You know, like I almost think like they might have pulled the trigger too early on her being a champion because she's sort of restricted a little bit by carrying that title and having to represent it as a serious champion in a lot of ways. So I think she would have a lot more freedom to be even stranger if she had held off on having that title right now. But I agree. I think as a character, she's having a blast. I just don't know if it's the best thing for the women's division right now.
Yeah, I enjoy Toni Storm. I don't know if it counts as a guilty pleasure or not, but her, you know, someone's pissed on my seat. Is that how things work around here after the brawl around the announce desk when she was at ringside for the Perrazzo Valkyrie match and her facial expression at the end? I mean, there's just what she's trying to do. I think she's doing a good job with it, a very good job with it, and I think there's a big part of the fan base that's into it. I see what you're saying, Jake, with, you know, well, you know, the world championship, maybe the gimmick's too gimmicky for the world championship. I think if they had a deeper women's roster and just one singles title, I would be more on board with that. I'm pausing to think, like, who would I want holding both women's titles if Toni Storm is just stealing the show every week? And so I think in Tony Khan's mind, he's thinking, I really like Toni Storm's character. She's having a blast with this. The crowd seems into it. I don't have two other women I want to feature more than her, so let's give her a title so that we're not sort of burying a champion while featuring her instead of the champion. That might be the mindset in terms of why they went with it. He also might have wanted, and it'd be interesting to get his insight into this, if he's thinking, we don't want Toni to be seen as a marginalized, gimmicky, mid-card comedy act. So we're going to give her a title to let people know, well, there's this, you know, black and white Hollywood delusional gimmick that she's doing. She's also a serious wrestler. But part of that then comes, how do you frame that and tell that story, both when she defends a title, but also in other ways? And I think they could hit that beat a little more often, saying, you know, whatever's going on in Toni Storm's head and whatever, you know, planet that she lives on when she's out here delusionally thinking she's a Hollywood star from, you know, the mid-20th century, she's really good in the ring, and she's got incredible credentials. And when the bell rings, yes, she still plays head games, but she is incredibly tough and an accomplished athlete. Like, tell that story in some way more. Talk it through, figure out how you're going to tell that so that she can be both at once, which I think is possible. But I'm not sure they do enough of that. Jake, anything you want to add to react to what I said, and then I'll throw back to Larry.
No, I think you hit on a lot of the same thoughts that I've been having about it. It's not that I dislike the character or even think that you know, that featuring her on TV is the wrong play. It's just they haven't quite hit the right balance for me when it comes to that, you know, that Women's World Championship, because it, you know, you have Toni, who feels a little bit handcuffed by it because she's clearly enjoying the character aspect of it more than, you know, the title defenses and the feud. But at the same time, it's tough for the other characters who are feuding with her because she's the heel and she says all this outrageous stuff. And yet, you know, when babyface characters or anybody is trying to interact with her, they get booed, you know? So I think it creates a tough scenario for other people to get over in her orbit. And that's why I question whether her being the title is the right move, but it's undeniably entertaining. I mean, there's, you know, you can't fault them for trying to maximize, you know, this character while it's, you know, while it's so over with the fan base. It's, I think it just creates problems in its wake as they go along with it.
Sure. Yep. Larry, back to you. Anything you want to say about anything Jake and I had to say about your question?
Well, I get where Jake's coming from on it and where you're coming from, that they could maybe tweak it a little bit more, and there may be certain limits as to what they could do with her, you know, with that, her being a champion and everything. But I wanted to go back to that, the match that Perrazzo had with Valkyrie, and I don't know if you two thought anything of it, but I was really impressed with the uniqueness of the finisher that Deonna used, and how Taya acted like it was just killing her to death when she gave up. It kind of reminded me a little bit, I don't know if it reminded either of you, of Doink the Clown's old finisher in the WWE, a stump puller kind of stretch thing.
Yeah, Jake, what do you think about that?
I think they're landing, you know, strongly with Deonna, in the sense that, you know, every match she's finishing people with brutal looking submissions, and that's the that's sort of the hook of her character. She's supposed to be this world class in-ring technician, and she has a lot of submissions in her arsenal. It kind of reminds you of Dean Malenko is probably the one that jumps to mind for me, who used to finish people in all kinds of different ways, you know, and maybe even like what Gunther does in WWE, where he's constantly innovating and using different paths to get to victory. I like it. I think as a technical wrestler, they're doing right by Deonna right now.
Larry, back to you.
And off that, I want to talk just maybe briefly about whatever the heck that was with Bullet Club, Bang Bang, Scissor Me, whatever. That's about 5 or 10 minutes of my life I'm not going to get back. What was the point of that? Or was there a point?
I do not have an answer for you. I guess you could make the case that when two factions link up and form a new faction, it's okay to have a segment where they come out and interact and kind of show off their chemistry with each other and the dynamic and how they're going to work together and establish sort of a baseline or a foundation for them. I think that was the point. I also think Tony Khan is thinking, hey, that's a lot of, I wouldn't say star power, but wrestlers who fans are into, you know, who fans react to. And so we'll put them out there and have six guys in the ring doing their shtick for a few minutes on TV. He studies minute by minute. I doubt if he thought that was going to drive people away, he would have, you know, put it on TV against his better judgment. But maybe we'll check minute by minute and see how it did. But I'm not going to say that it felt like a particularly a pertinent segment that left us. I don't think it left people liking them more, and I think it might cause them to like them less, because it did sort of feel almost like something you would do after a TV show goes off the air, Jake, to just like, hey, crowd, thanks for coming, and interact with the crowd like you would at a house show or after a TV taping ends, more than something that needed to be on television. Jake, your thoughts, can you make a case for it, or are you kind of with Larry, be perplexed what the purpose was?
Yeah, I think the idea is just to establish an on-screen chemistry and a bond between, you know, these two disparate factions now sort of forming and joining together. I have to believe that, I think is Revolution the first or second week of March, so we're probably like 4 or 5 weeks from the pay-per-view at this point. And
I think we have four dynamites to go.
And so they're probably going to do like a rapid, you know, put these guys together and then shatter them apart so that they can have a match. you know, at that pay-per-view. So they're trying to, you know, to create some you know, a moment between them on television so that people can be shocked and appalled when the Bullet Club Gold turns on you know, on the Acclaimed and Daddy Ass one more time, I guess. But it felt like a low point in the show, that's for sure.
Yeah. Larry, back to you.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I Jay White, you know, is a legitimate world-class wrestler. The Guns, for their time in wrestling, are really good. The Acclaimed, you know, are entertaining. And Billy Gunn is just borderline freak of nature with the condition he's in at his age and his experience. But watching that just made me kind of just cringe a little bit. But pivoting from that, I wanted to ask you what you had heard about what they thought the final attendance was for the show. I had been guessing it was around 2,000, maybe 2,100. And to AEW's credit, their production crew did as much as they could, as well as they could, to make it look like there was more than 2,000 there. Or at least make it look like it wasn't 2,000.
Yeah, WrestleTix had them under 2,000 heading into the show. I haven't seen from them a final number. But yeah, I mean, they did a good job. They've got the LED boards now up on the ringside barricade opposite the hard cam at ringside for wrestler logos and add, I guess, some sponsorship plugs and that type of thing too. And just a little energy and vibrancy. And then they're setting up like these three spotlight, this kind of triple spotlight in between the last row of the floor seats and the bleachers, which creates some sense of an endpoint to your eyes that is in total blackness because of all the empty seats. And then from a camera angle standpoint, that floating camera behind the heads of fans in the floor seats that captures the ring in the mid-ground and then the stage in the background also, I think, is a good production technique. I think they are, as you say, Larry, making the best of the circumstances with the small crowd. So it didn't bother me, but there's also, and I say this all the time, a real absence of it feeling big time. So while I don't think it dragged down the show or took me out of the moment, it doesn't feel like a big time happening. Like when WWE puts the camera in the last row of a major NBA NHL arena that's sold out and they light it up to the back row and they tout the sellouts, that makes it feel like a hot product. As good of a job as they did, and I praise them for the job that they did with what they had to work with, mitigating the negative, there is an absence of it feeling big time. There's an absence of these wrestlers feeling like big stars. Imagine if you dropped tonight's show into a full Capital One Center in D.C., like the first Dynamite, and you had everything happening, but the lights are up and the crowd is reacting, but it's a crowd of 12,000, not two. It's just a completely different vibe about how big of a star Hangman and Swerve are, how big of a deal Joe is, how big of a star Tony Storm is now, you know, how Moxley has landed in a place where he's as over as ever. So, yeah, I mean, you know, good job with what they have to work with. But what they have to work with is a result of some decisions they made the last couple of years that they're paying a bit of a price for. Jake, your take on 2 weeks in a row now with, you know, 2,000 give or take for a Wednesday major cable network live sports like event.
I think they gotta figure out what they can do to avoid running towns that WWE was in within a week or two of the broadcast, because you had this show happening I think within 2 or 3 weeks of Raw being in New Orleans, and Dynamite ended up being the more expensive ticket. And so I think they have some promotional issues they have to work on. Obviously, you know, the booking, contributes to the overall feeling of the show being hot versus not. You're absolutely right. You know, they threw as much of smoke and mirrors as they could produce with the lighting and the camera work. You know, it wasn't obvious that there was a very, you know, small crowd in the building. And I think they had the crowd mic'd well enough that it was,
yeah,
you know, the vocal fans that were there were picked up well on the TV broadcast. And so if you weren't thinking about it or you weren't already aware of it, you probably would not have, thought that there were only 2,000 people in the building. But, from a business standpoint, they have quite a bit of work cut out for them because they're coming back to these places after you know, a year or, you know, 18 months or, you know, in some markets, you know, sooner, and they're drawing less every time. And that's not the sign of a company doing strong business.
Russell Ticks did send out an update an hour ago, and the final count by their estimate of tickets distributed, that's sold in comps, is 2236. So they got over 2,000. The previous time they visited that arena was for a Dynamite on April 13th, 2022, almost 3,655. So they're down one third, roughly, from where they were before, I guess a little more than that. And that's what you just said, Jake. You know, on return visits, they're drawing fewer fans. And it's not like they burned the market out. I mean, it's been, you know, almost 2 years since they were in that building. And, I mean, and again, this, I'll say it briefly. I say it a lot. When they announced Collision, I said one of the issues here is going to be going to towns twice as often or going to towns they would not have gone to otherwise because the demand isn't there. And it's going to diminish the visual appeal and the ability to portray what you're doing as a hot product and that your wrestlers are big stars if you are drawing smaller and smaller crowds and darkening these arenas. And you have to weigh that against the benefit of having 2 extra hours of TV time to market for a new TV deal. And that calculation was made. I think Tony Khan was thinking he would have CM Punk as a star on available to him and probably Kenny Omega too. But, you know, he's had some bad luck with injuries and departures and such. But nevertheless, you kind of have to deal with that. Wardlow might be added to the list with his knee buckling and him kind of having the same expression Seth did after his match last week. They might be down one more star that they were banking on, which doesn't leave their heel faction, a guy in a wheelchair and another guy with a knee injury, and you're left with Taven Bennett and Strong. That's not great for Undisputed. Not Era. I have all of them in my head.
Kingdom.
Yes, Undisputed Kingdom. But nevertheless, yeah, I mean, they are where they are. And, you know, I don't know if they're going to – I don't know if Tony would consider canceling Collision, but it would certainly make Dynamite, I think, a stronger show visually if they were only going to towns that they knew could draw and weeding out the bottom half that don't draw well. And clearly right now they can't afford to do that because they have to produce live TV twice a week, not just once. Larry, go ahead. Anything else you want?
No, I think that'll about do it for me. You've got a few more callers to get to. I'm sure there's still plenty to talk about, so I'll just keep listening. And so long from the land of Lincoln.
Thanks, Larry. Appreciate it. We are hoping to hear from our on-site correspondent soon if they were going to stay to watch Rampage. So if that ends in time, we'll be hearing from an on-site correspondent. But next, we'll go to James in Clemson, although if you want to get in line, you can still call us, and we invite you to do so, 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558, and push 1 on your keypad to let us know that you want to be on the show. James, welcome back to the show. Good to hear from you. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Hey, Wade. Hey, Jake. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Young Bucks. Honestly, I think it's kind of starting to grow on me a little bit. I kind of like the heelish demeanor. I could almost kind of see them like it's almost like they're wrestlers who are pretending to be GMs or something like that. But it's Matthew and Nicholas are starting to it's starting to grow on me. I've had the same feelings that you've had over the past few weeks, Wade. So. Yeah, just kind of give a state of the union on where you stand this week.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a fan of ever talking about active wrestlers being EVPs. I mean, I just don't think you need to say that. I don't think there's any benefit to it. And if you try to turn it into a benefit, it's just drawing attention to an awkward situation, which is an awkward wrestler is in charge of, it's an awkward situation in that wrestlers have power over other wrestlers who they're competing with. And you would just never have that. You wouldn't have that in sports. I mean, you wouldn't give power to players who they're playing against or fighting against in MMA or boxing or whatever. So I just think it's a bad idea to begin with. And now they're drawing even more attention to it than ever. If Tony Khan is in charge and making matches and being mentioned by Shivani and Excalibur, he must be complicit in allowing the Bucks to be doing this, because if not, what's the power structure? Why are the Bucks able to fine people and threaten people? without Tony Khan intervening? And that question is, I think, on the minds of viewers. Like, what kind of power do they have? And why? And if Tony has ultimate power, why does he allow them to get away with it? And you can say, well, just have fun. Don't think that hard about it. Well, that's fine, but that's a different level of enjoying wrestling, which is things here don't make sense. And but for me to enjoy it, I have to just kind of dumb it down and just watch it like I watched Looney Tunes cartoons when I was six. You know, oh, he just got hit with an anvil and now he's fine in the next scene. Don't worry about it. Just enjoy the action. And that's kind of where we are with them. Jake, what do you think about the EVP aspect and them leaning into it the way they are? And then other aspects of it too. The new look, the new attitudes, and their actual words. We have an email on it too that's specific we'll get into. But I'm curious for your take on the revamped, refreshed Young Bucks, Nicholas and Matthew.
Well, I guess as far as the wrestlers pretending to be executives aspect of it, I guess depending on who you ask, it's a little bit of art imitating life in a way. But it surfaces the question automatically, like, okay, so they've always been EVPs, and they're just sort of now displaying the fact that they have, you know, this authority over production. You know, like, clearly, they, you know, one of the backstage segments on the show was them commanding Renee Paquette to ask Darby Allin a very specific question and then butt into the interview when he started to give an answer. And so, like, what were they doing with this authority before when it wasn't a part of their on-screen personas? And that, you know, that will never be addressed. You know, it's just, and so it makes the entire thing sort of awkward, because now that they're heels, well, of course, you know, they're going to abuse their authority, or at least that's what you're supposed to believe. But are we supposed to, you know, think that all the other times they were heels, they weren't abusing their authority when they weren't talking about it? And so I think it just, I'm not a huge fan of the idea of making this an on-television angle, because it makes everything that they've done in the past suspect, and they're never going to address why or why not they weren't abusing their power before.
Just setting aside the EVP aspect of it, how do you think they're doing just executing being a smarmy agitating heels?
I think they're suited fine for it. You know, I'm glad they went away from the pencil mustaches to goatees. I think everybody should avoid any possible comparison to Vince McMahon at this point. But as far as their acting ability and the way that they're they're handling themselves, I think they're doing an okay job of making you question their motives. And, identify them as authority figures who are leaning on other people to get their dirty work done. So I guess the execution of it is fine. I just think the premise of it has a couple of flaws that are just impossible to wrap your head around.
Yeah. I mean, even if they have been abusing their power before and we didn't know it, or they weren't and now they are, it doesn't change my overriding question as a viewer, which is, why does Tony Khan allow it? And if it's because they're EVPs and he gave them power that he can't rescind, how is that possible? Like, to me, any abuse that crosses the line from being annoying to really changing the course of championship contendership or championship matches, or undercutting wrestlers who just deserve to have the opportunities that they earn, if Tony Khan doesn't step in, then he's complicit. And I just think that's a story that you can't tell coherently unless you've thought it through and you have an answer. And I can't even conjure up an answer that would make sense, because, you know, he bestowed upon them EVP status. And so you would have to explain that somehow. Or, again, just as fans, don't think so hard. Just enjoy, you know, all the high spots in the snarkiness, and don't worry too much about the details, which is, you know, what they want us to think about with Undisputed Kingdom and the whole Devil storyline. Oh, don't worry about the details of when Adam Cole wasn't really MJF's friend and when he was. And if he really was, you know, at Roderick Strong's house doing all these tasks, or if that was just a show put on to trick MJF, all that stuff. It's like, I just want my T's crossed and I's dotted when it comes to these storylines. And this is another one that I kind of fear they haven't thought through, or they think people won't care. And they might be right. Some people won't care. I'm sure some people listening don't care. But I think when you're trying to grow your audience, you want coherence and logic so that when the Bucks get away with something, you kind of understand why, as opposed to just thinking the company's not really telling a story very well. James, back to you. You want to add anything to this?
I know I heard you talking to Greg Parks, and he mentioned that he kind of worries, or one of you were saying it, that you kind of worry that this is going to is something that's only being done for the coming match at Revolution. And I think that's kind of my worst fear of it. So I just want to see what happens in the follow-up. Like, do the Young Bucks continue to build these characters, or do they go back into their old ways? Yeah, so that's really the only other thing I have to say about it. So overall tonight, I thought it was a pretty good show overall. It was a little predictable, but I felt like the atmosphere was definitely better than last week. But one thing tonight was glaringly bad to me, and that was that Moxley segment, the post-match, when the locker room made the save and there were only four locker room people. I guess everybody else, they must have something really good in catering, like some brisket tacos or something, because nobody came out there to help Moxley. And I think the crowd was confused about it too. And it was just overall really poorly executed, in my opinion. So, throw to you guys on that one.
Yeah, Jake, so talk about what James brought up, and then broaden it out too about Tony Khan, AEW bringing in CMLL luchadors, and we get a little bit of background from Excalibur, just a tiny bit on them, but it's even more mass wrestlers. Suddenly one of them is taking on Bryan Danielson on Saturday on Collision. Do you think there's potential here and they're just building the foundation, or do you think this is another case of playing to a real narrow audience who's going to be like, yes, AEW's working with CMLL, and we're going to have these luchadors who I'm familiar with wrestling some top AEW guys, and they're sort of micro-marketing to a very small niche audience?
Well, I Excalibur giving the very brief introductions is doing, the angle and the incoming luchadors a disservice. Why weren't there vignettes when this partnership was announced? And why weren't you introducing these folks to your broader audience? So when they do show up and they do, interact with AEW wrestlers, you at least have a basis of, we've done some basic introductory work. This is what you can expect from these talents. This is kind of the framework of what their personality is and their, what they do in the ring. You cut all that together and spend a couple of minutes on a video package to kind of give people just the very basics of how this is going to work. But I think there was some, confusion with the way it was introduced, because this has all been kind of thrown together very quickly, and you have, matches being announced, and you're as a viewer, you're supposed to be excited about Bryan Danielson against Hedgesero, and there's going to be a trios match next week, with three of these guys against the Blackpool Combat Club. I know they showed a graphic, but I think it was Hedgesero and Volador and Mystico that were going to be in that trios match, but don't quote me on that because I may be misremembering. But it does give you that feeling like this is being introduced and targeted at a very niche audience. The crossover between CMLL and AEW is very small, and so you have to sort of create something, and it feels like they're once again sort of leaving the audience to do the groundwork themselves. And depending on who you are, you may or may not be even interested in going into those depths in researching these characters and figuring out who they are and why you should be excited about a match. You just kind of want the promotion to do that work for you. And I think AEW constantly, kind of drops the ball, whether it's, bringing in the New Japan guys or the people they brought in from AAA in the past. They don't do enough of that laying the foundation work to make these matches feel like actual events. This isn't like the Outsiders coming into WCW or the Radicals coming into the WWF in the late 90s. You don't have the you know, the familiarity that audiences already possessed from seeing these guys on nationally televised, you know, wrestling shows for years before they showed up. You know, these are largely unknown folks unless you're already a fan of CMLL and Lucha Libre. And I think the audience crossover is very small. And so I think it's just a bit of a letdown in the sense that there might have been potential here, but it feels like they're already starting to squander it before it started.
Yeah. All right, James, anything else you want to bring up before we move on?
Yep, just one more thing, kind of a bit of a broader subject. I've been watching primarily AEW since the beginning of AEW, and I stopped watching WWE before AEW even started, but I did watch the Royal Rumble this weekend. I usually watch the Royal Rumble every year, but this year I came away very, very impressed by WWE. And I think there were a lot of things on that show that AEW should be paying attention to and taking note of. You know, the people in the Rumble, there's a lot of them. I had no clue who they were, and WWE did a really good job of explaining who they were. I knew who Jordynne Grace was, and that was the first time I've ever seen her in my life. And it's just a different feel than when AEW brings in some outsiders like we're talking about now, and you know, by the end of it, I can't tell you their names, but I can tell you who Jordynne Grace was. And then, you know, to me, I really feel like the cons think they can buy a wrestling company and, you know, just go buy these big arenas and people will show up. And they're missing 50 years of, you know, just building to that point that WWE has, and that's fine, but the cons need to slow it down. We've said it over and over, just too fast of growth. And you know, the Royal Rumble has grown to a stadium show, like organically. And AEW just needs to sit back and just kind of figure out some things that are going to make them put them on the map. Maybe come up with a match like the Royal Rumble that has big implications for the main event of All In. Something, you know, just to kind of like start laying some better groundwork is what I'm looking for, because there's, I just don't know really what the identity of this company is lately. And then also I did kind of pop when Triple H mentioned at the press conference something about the we don't need to open doors here or something like that. It kind of cracked me up a little bit, but, but yeah, that's all I have
James,
to say for tonight.
Before you go,
yeah, go ahead.
James, before you go, just elaborate a little more on revisiting the WWE product after being away for a while. What stood out to you? Cause they are in a different place than they were 5 years ago as a company. And you mentioned, you know, that, they did a good job introducing the wrestlers to you who you didn't know. But just what else about the product intrigued you, and did it cause you to rethink not watching them, or is it more, no, I'll just check in for the Rumble every year and enjoy it, but I'm still going to keep watching AEW?
Yeah, the pace was different. It just has like this big-time feel that AEW doesn't have, and all along I've kind of thought AEW and WWE were competitors. But I think I kind of realized this weekend, no, WWE is dominant, and AEW the only thing they can do is try their best to keep up. I think the Netflix deal, it really is going to put AEW on notice. They need to be on notice, because that's a big thing going on, and they can either grow from it or they can die from it. And so some of the things that, like I said, it just feels like a big show. Like I'm watching some top stars. Cody is like the prime example to me. He just feels 100 times bigger in WWE than he did in AEW. CM Punk feels like a big star, although he does kind of just feel like CM Punk to me. It's nothing like different. You know, I think that's the main thing, is they just know how to make people care about wrestlers. It's very different. So yeah, I'm kind of rambling at this point, but
are you going to watch
WWE
or not?
You know, Wade, I've thought a lot about that, and I, I'm right now, like, my night of the week is Wednesday, and it's kind of the night that works for me. It's my habit I've built.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't have to watch AEW on Wednesdays. It's a different world now where I can really watch whatever I want. So, if, like, sure. If it comes right down to it, maybe I can watch SmackDown on Wednesdays. So, AEW just yeah. should be careful and really make sure. I hope Tony Khan paid attention this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting point of view. James, appreciate it. James brought up, Jake, that I asked Greg Parks on the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast flagship show yesterday, which is free and available to everybody on our blue feed. Just search Wade Keller. You'll see this show, our red feed. Subscribe to that if you haven't, especially because you're listening to it somehow otherwise. And then subscribe to the Blue Logo Show for our weekly flagship and some other content on there, including some classic interviews. I asked Greg, what is AEW's identity in 2024? And that led to us discussing, you know, Samoa Joe and the prospects of him if he were champion for the whole year, what opponents he would face and that kind of thing. But what is left for AEW's identity to be in light of where they are, drawn 2,200 fans, 2 weeks in a row roughly, losing CM Punk, Kenny Omega out of action and sort of floundering in general otherwise, MJF gone for now, WWE, a hot product, running stadium shows, drawing big crowds, sellout crowds, and near-packed houses or packed houses for Raw and SmackDown, you know, bright lights, a sense of being at a peak level of success, as James brought up the Netflix deal. What is different about AEW's purpose now versus five, six years ago when it was starting to become an idea and then launching? And where are they now as far as that identity goes?
Well, I think, you know, a lot of things that people used to associate with AEW as an identity, whether it was having a more sports-like feel or, you know, having these raucous crowds in largely sold-out buildings, it sort of feels like WWE has stolen a lot of that from them over the last couple of years, whether, you know, and you can see that on full display on Raw on Monday. You know, you had WWE make that major hire of Lee Fitting, and suddenly, you know, you're watching, whether it's the Rumble or whether it's Monday Night Raw, the show takes on a much more ESPN-like feel. You know, if you've watched the NBA or you've watched how ESPN has covered major sporting events and how they produce them, you know, seeing people walking in the back, a lot of the, you know, the high-end graphical effects and transitions that they were doing, highlighting, you know, the major stars and showing, you know, their personalized graphics and some of their highlights. And so, you know, there's things that that I think WWE is doing that AEW was once, you know, sort of pioneering at a point where, you know, when Vince McMahon was still in charge and WWE was sort of adrift creatively, you know, and the wrestling audience was all well aware of that. You know, AEW had some built-in advantages that have suddenly been taken away. And so I think, you know, we're at the point now where AEW has some soul searching to do. You know, they got to figure out, you know, what their new identity is going to be competing against this revitalized and changed WWE product. And I just don't feel like Tony Khan stayed ahead of that at all. You know, it feels like he has rested on his laurels of, well, I can book, you know, dream match cards. I can, you know, bring in talents from New Japan and Mexico and you know, really excite the core wrestling audience. But I think he's sort of digging himself further into the ground. You know, he's lost ground and he's sort of dug in. And I don't know what this company's identity is at this point. It doesn't seem like they know, because they're constantly reintroducing new concepts and reintroducing old ones like the rankings to try and throw things against the wall and see what sticks. It doesn't seem like there's a firm vision for the future of AEW right now. And it is concerning because, you know, their business is declining as far as live attendance goes, and their ratings are, you know, are below par from where they were just a year or two ago. And they're coming into a very intense year of having to renegotiate their television contract. And so I think a lot of things have to come together for AEW right now, all the while they're producing, you know, 5 hours of weekly television, struggling to fill buildings, creatively, you know, leaving a little bit of something to be desired in terms of their character development and how they're framing stars and making them feel like special attractions. And so they got to find their way soon. I think a lot of that just rolls, rolls to Tony Khan's shoulders because he has decided to, you know, to be the where the buck stops creatively for just about everything. And so it's hard to see the company changing unless he has a change in philosophy, which he's been very committed to thus far.
Well put. Yep. What do you think of the rankings coming back, by the way, as a concept now that we have the first batch of them in front of us? Is this a way to kind of go back to the roots and say this is what we're going to be about? And did you see enough and hear enough tonight and really over the last week and a half since they announced this on Collision to think, yeah, they're going to do this right or better or different in a way that has potential?
Well, if you're publishing a top five and you have four singles champions, it does sort of dilute, you know, like who is, you know, qualified to challenge for what and why would they? I don't think you can use rankings as a replacement for storytelling. And that's something that, that they found out very early on because they were trying to arrange cards around shuffling the rankings around so that people could fall into contention for titles. And when that became too complex, they just sort of abandoned the rankings because it was too difficult to maintain and make sense of over time. And people kept pointing out that, well, you know, why is the number six team in the rankings getting a tag title shot before number two or three? They rightfully abandoned it at the time. I thought it was the right choice because it became too cumbersome for them to manage. And so I'm very curious if they can do things differently this time around and manage it a bit better. But you know, you look at the rankings and it's like, okay, so the number two challenger to the tag team champions is John Silver and Alex Reynolds. You know, like when's the last time anybody, you know, was talking about them in a way where you're like, oh man, I can't wait to see them challenge for the tag titles. And, yeah, you know, Danielson and Castagnoli at number three, it's like, I mean, two very talented singles acts, but I mean, have they been regularly competing on Dynamite and Collision to the point where you're like, oh, they're building towards the tag title run? And so I think they're in a tough spot because, you know, you put these rankings together and it poses more questions than it answers in a lot of ways. And I'm very curious how they react to it week to week here and how long they stick to it, really.
I assume one of the reasons that the Young Bucks are not in the top five is because they haven't wrestled lately. And that's going to be part of the story, is that they gift themselves a title shot using their influence as EVPs. But it's tough when you have a top five and you have Silver and Reynolds in it and not the Young Bucks, and they're obviously working towards the tag title match, and it's just a little bit hard to take them super seriously. Even with Orange Cassidy and Trent, I mean, they have, I think, three tag team title wins this year. Otherwise, Orange Cassidy's been wrestling singles matches or teaming with others. And that moves them into, you know, the top five. It does sort of advertise, we don't have a particularly strong, deep tag team division right now. And then you throw in Silver and Reynolds, obviously, and then Danielson and Claudio. And if you're going to release your rankings, maybe like plan 10 weeks ahead and make sure that when they come out, you've got some good stories to tell instead of, wait, what the heck is John Silver doing as the number two ranked, part of the number two ranked tag team?
Yeah, it's just a tough place to be because you announced it and people get excited about it and they start building expectations in their head about what this is going to mean and then you put out the first rankings and it's just like, okay, well, I guess we got a lot of work ahead of us, you know, and so we'll. I'll keep an eye on it week to week and see if they change my mind. But I guess I'd call myself a skeptic at this point.
Yeah. I'm looking up Dark Order's matches here and looking at how many times they've won recently. I mean, I guess they'd have some wins on three of their last five televised matches, or three out of the last four televised matches were dark matches, and they were victories that have not been talked about. And they were over Julio Cruz and Victor Chase and Brandon Cutler and Colt Cabana twice. Those are their dark match wins. And then they were in a six-man tag, and then the Battle Royal. And before that, they were in the losing end of a tag team match against Parker Menard and Jake Hager. And then before that, going back to December, they did beat Brandon Cutler and Colt Cabana in another dark match. I mean, if we're going to look for quality of opposition, and you can look at these rankings and dive into it, and like actually, like I've recommended, do a YouTube show where you talk about each of them and the rationale for where they're ranked. How does beating Colt Cabana and Brandon Cutler three times and the Brick City Boys give them number two ranking? I mean, it's absurd. It's farcical. So in that sense, that's I don't know if that's the weakest point in all this, because I haven't dissected them all, but it's not a strong point.
So there's no NCAA strength of schedule sort of considerations being done here, because if somebody can go on a tear in dark matches and on Rampage against relatively unknown competition and build up a long undefeated streak, then technically, I guess, are they supposed to be number one if they're 9-0 in a particular match category for the year? And so it definitely does create some sticky situations where it's like, okay, you're going to name these people the number one contenders, and they don't feel like the audience is connected to them in any particular way. That's what makes the balancing of the sports aspect of this rankings presentation and the narrative aspect of producing a wrestling television show sort of difficult to balance with one another.
And for clarity's sake too, because AEW kind of like ruined what the term dark meant, because they were filming their dark matches and putting on a show called AEW Dark. That show is now canceled. Now when I say dark match, it's the term that's been around for decades and decades, which means a match that takes place before or after a live TV show or a pay-per-view, but usually, it's on TV shows, warm-up match for the crowd or something to send them home afterwards. And that's what I'm referring to. I'm not referring to the return of the YouTube series. All right, let's go to our onsite correspondent, Mitch, who attended tonight. He was one of the 2,200 loud and proud fans in the arena tonight. Mitch, thanks for calling. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hey, Mitch. Are you ready for us?
Yep, I just got in my car and phone transferred over.
Yep.
As we did.
Yeah. So. Absolutely. Cool. I'm glad you were able to give us a call after attending tonight. Overall, did you have a good time? It's been over a year and a half, almost 2 years since they were in that venue.
Yes. Yeah, last time they were in the venue, it opened with CM Punk versus Penta. So,
oh, wow.
yeah. But, it was a good show. It was a pretty good show. I went to Raw, too, so I got to compare the two. But, yeah, we all enjoyed it. For sure.
Yeah. So they closed Dynamite with Swerve and Hangman. I'm curious what the crowd reaction was for Swerve and Hangman, and also compared to Samoa Joe coming out for commentary. Was it obvious that fans were more loudly cheering one or two of them compared to the other? I mean, technically they're all up for grabs in terms of who fans choose as their favorite. There's not a lot of steering people hard for or against them. I mean, Joe's been more of a heel against Hook. Swerve was a heel with Prince Nana interfering obnoxiously on his behalf, but fans love him. Hangman's a beloved AEW original, but has a little bit more of an edge to him lately, and has an association lingering with the Young Bucks, who are now heels. So how did the crowd react to all of them tonight?
So I would say Swerve for sure was the loudest pop. I would put him in like the top tier, and Hangman would be like right below that. And then Joe, I got the impression that he was main. People were chanting Joe more because it's fun to chant Joe, and that's just something you do. I feel like if Joe had done anything to entice the crowd might have turned. But yeah, Swerve makes you wonder why he's being portrayed as a heel, because people want to cheer.
Yeah.
So honestly, that's the vibe I got, and there were a lot of Swerve signs in the crowd.
Interesting.
In our section, I could see them. Whereas there were not, I didn't see any Hangman show.
How did Nostalgia Act, Rob Van Dam, compare in terms of crowd reaction?
Very loud. Louder than I would have thought. Like, arguably the biggest pop.
Yeah, that's probably the biggest pop.
I think it was the biggest pop.
Yeah.
I was a little surprised how loud. Not that it was loud, but, yeah, very loud. And a lot of nostalgia. But I also got the impression that this crowd was a lot of veteran wrestling fans. So most people had probably watched him and stuff, or at least had seen him in WWE or heard of him.
So I'm going back to the top of the show.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Finish your thought. Yep. No, finish your thought.
Oh, and then when he hit his spots, too, it was a loud pop for all of his high spots as well. So it wasn't just that initial RVD, which some people got that initial pop tonight, and then it died afterwards. His was consistent throughout the match, I would say, the energy of the crowd.
Cool, yep. So I want to go back to the beginning of the show, and also similar question. How did the crowd react to Jon Moxley compared to Jeff Hardy? I know Jeff's in the midst of what may or may not work as a heel turn. Moxley was part of a heel group that fans just perpetually cheered, so a little bit muddled. But it's a hardcore crowd. You'd think they're up on storylines, and they also seem like the type of crowd that would just like Jon Moxley. So talk about the crowd reaction for them for intros and also during the match with the ebb and flow.
So Jon Moxley also had a really loud pop intro. I personally didn't know he was going to be there. He wasn't advertised. I mean, I didn't look deep into the show about who was going to be there. I just kind of checked the email, and you know how often the website's updated. So I was surprised, and I don't think I was the only one who was surprised he was there. So that contributed to his pop. I don't think it was also consistent throughout the match and even at the end, and there was a spot that was almost assuredly on the commercial break where he was acting all kind of dazed and beat up and wobbling around, and that was even getting cheers after he got beat down by the CMLL guys, which it sounds like that's going to be a match next week based on what we heard we're leaving. It's BCC versus those guys. Hardy got cheered, and there were Hardy signs in the crowd again.
Yeah.
There were tons of Hardy signs. Not tons, but a few. Hardy T-shirts. I don't think turning him heel is going to work because it's just too much of a nostalgia act. Even when he made the obscene gesture to Moxley, and even when he kind of cheated, it just didn't matter. And I also think AEW has kind of, unfortunately, everyone just does whatever they want at this point, because the same thing happened with, I don't want to go too into Rampage, but with Private Party, when they tried to do heel stuff, nobody seemed to really care. They still got cheered and everything. And I felt with Matt Hardy, even me being a knowledgeable fan, I didn't feel like I needed to boo the guy for anything, because Jon Moxley did some pretty despicable stuff too, and he does despicable things all the time. So at this point, I mean, it was a no DQ match that had a chair and someone getting their ear twisted almost off with a pin. So him kind of cheating too was just par for the course. We didn't know it was a non-DQ match when it came on. So it just all went like blended together. Now, people enjoyed it. So this is kind of the double-edged sword, I feel like, with AEW. The crowd reacted. I mean, I reacted. It was fun to watch and be there for. But was this the most logical thing? Absolutely not. There was a no DQ match that there was no indication it was no DQ. But that's what it was. So, but definitely a hot opener and set the stage for the show and got the crowd pumped. But right after Tony did, too. He's got a really good way of pumping people up.
Mitch, you missed out on commentary. Early in the match, Excalibur said that the rules had been softened. He understands the rules for the match have been relaxed because fans have wanted to see this for so long. Not quite sure of the logic of that, that rules get in the way of matches being enjoyable, and if you really are excited about a match, we're going to throw the rules out. That just seems silly, and again, there's just no attention to detail or logic or precision in terms of the logic. It's just more a reason. It's more a way to try to create a little lip service for two wrestlers who just want to have a hardcore style match, but why not just announce that officially and leave people like you less confused by the lack of enforcement of rules. It's just sloppiness. It doesn't do
well. They did it for the RVD match.
Please me.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but they did announce to us for the RVD, this is a hardcore match, which got a huge pop. So the crowd got up. There was genuine confusion of, hey, he's using that chair in front of the ref. What's going on? And people just rolled with it.
I know.
Like I said, it kind of is that double-edged sword. Did he get the pop? Yeah, so I could see where Tony could try to just, it's not a – but does this make logical sense? And that would be my biggest takeaway is there is a lack of storytelling. If you like great matches, the show is a lot of fun. If you enjoy a coherent story in your wrestling match, the WWE show had less great wrestling, but the stories made more sense, if that makes sense, which also 2 years ago I wouldn't have said.
Jake, do you have a question for Mitch about his experience tonight?
Yeah, you had mentioned you were just at the Raw show that was there, I guess, a little over a week ago, and you were here tonight. I guess from a demographic standpoint, how would you draw distinctions between the types of people you saw at WWE show versus the people you saw here at AEW?
There were more kids and families at the WWE show. I'd say racial diversity was about the same, though, as far as, different mix everybody in with that. But there were definitely more. There were kids at the AW show. Some were wearing WWE shirts. But there were definitely more. Yeah. And new WWE shirts like Yeet. But there were definitely more families and more kids at the WWE. And it was so I would say this show is more of a date night slash like me and a buddy went tonight and his aunt went tonight. And the other show was definitely more of a, hey, this is a great family outing or type of thing. And whereas AEW comes across more as if both people like AEW, either some friends to hang out or a date night. But I would say there was a decent amount of women at this show. Considering more women at WWE, but a lot more than definitely a standard Ring of Honor show. So like I said, there were definitely couples there and stuff like that at this show. So I think it was a pretty good mix. But if you're from kids' perspective, WWE blew them out of the water.
Yeah, no surprise. Jake, anything else you want to ask Mitch?
Yeah, I guess we were talking about this earlier regarding it seeming like there was maybe somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 tickets moved for this event. Were you guys all kind of crowded onto the side of the arena opposite the hard cam? And I guess how was everything lit? Did it look a lot different than what you saw at Raw, a week ago or so?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that. So one thing I noticed immediately was there was significantly less people at this event than the last time they were here. I didn't sell out, I don't think, the last time, but this is a smaller arena. So to give you guys perspective, when, WrestleMania comes to New Orleans and we had NXT shows and Ring of Honor shows dueling, Ring of Honor would be in this arena and NXT would be in the Smoothie King Arena, which is where Raw was. So Raw was pretty much – not every seat was sold out, but everything was pretty much full. Some of the top deck was fairly empty-ish. There were definitely people there, and it was definitely a hot, sold-out crowd. This was also a hot crowd. I don't want to imply it wasn't, but I think there were two seats in the top deck that were sold. And to be honest, there's not a bad seat there. We paid about the same for our tickets, or I did. I had good seats all around. I was right by that table spot with the Imperium and the New Day. I was close to that. And then for this, there's an opposite the hard cam. So, there was no one opposite, on the hard cam side, literally no one. So, because I was looking for that. But, I would say two-thirds full, maybe. It wasn't absolutely horrible. It wasn't embarrassing, oh, my God, there's nobody here. But it was definitely better last time. But they also did a better job of promoting who was going to be there. And we were talking about, we kind of felt like we got some of the B show. because, I mean, we're getting the tag. Well, we did on Rampage. I heard you guys talking about the Dark Order did get their – I'm not going to spoil it, but they got their tag title shot against Big Bill and Ricky Starks. But we didn't
well, that
get
could
that.
Just screw up
we
next got, week's Dynamite, couldn't it?
You're to find out. It might mess the whole – it might change everything. I'm not going to spoil it because I don't want to take that
right.
Chance away from everybody.
Yes.
Yeah. But, yeah, the Jericho match was better than I actually thought it would be with the spots. But I was like, man, we couldn't get Kanosuke, Takeshita, or anybody, or even a physical – like, we just kind of got a lot of the – we didn't get a whole lot of A talent, I felt like, as was tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of the B guys, except Moxley, which was a good surprise. But, and Swerve,
yeah.
I would say Swerve and Hangman. But I wouldn't put – they're not the – like, it's not Danielson, Omega, Young Bucks. That's kind of what I mean. Like, the guys who've been there to really move pay-per-view and have been champions, stuff like that. Although Swerve, if they handle it right, could be that guy. I just don't know what they're going to do. So.
Chris Jericho wrestled – oh, sorry, Mitch. You faded out a little bit.
I just said
when Chris Jericho – yeah. So Chris Jericho added some star power. I'm curious what the crowd reaction – was for him, because for a couple weeks there were some, you know, gimmicks used to maybe try to not put him in a position to have fans chanting NDA and other things at him. I guess we had a much bigger scandal last week. Was there any sense that among the 2,200 that WrestlePix reported attended that there were any anti-Jericho chants?
I think I heard in the very beginning a very small amount. I think I caught that. But then they stopped because people started cheering and singing the song, the Judas song.
Yeah.
So my reaction, because I was actually listening to that about all the stuff going on, I think he's thanking God that what happened in the other scandal totally overlaps his. So he's probably excited about that. And I kind of got that impression. I mean, there was a few, I don't even know if it was boos. I really couldn't understand, but it didn't sound positive. But those people even stopped. Like, it wasn't like they tried to overpower everybody else and know I'm adamant I'm going to be heard on this. It seemed like they were just kind of like, okay. And they gave up. Hulk Hogan got a worse response. I think this was off the air and Raw than he did when they did, like, a little promo for Hulk Hogan. So,
actually, elaborate on that. What was the reaction to Hogan?
So he did this weird, like, promo and, oh, I might come in the Royal Rumble, and there were active boos.
Yeah.
And, there was certain people were even booing even louder than others. And most people, like myself, was just sitting there, like, what are you doing? Like, why are you doing this? You know, it's stupid. So it was probably the worst thing you could get in wrestling. It was some light booing and no reaction. So it was like, yeah, you probably stop doing this. This is the worst reaction.
Yeah.
Whereas Jericho did get cheered. So for what, so I think people are kind of, my assumption is, at least here, is they're moving on, but they don't know. One of the two. They've forgotten. I think people have forgotten. They're being honest.
Let's talk about the women's segment. Johnny TV coming out with Ty Valkyrie, Deonna Purrazzo coming up, Tony Storm coming out to do commentary. Who got – describe the reactions that the wrestlers got and how into this match were the fans compared to other matches and segments on the show?
Oh, I think they were pretty into it. Deonna Purrazzo got a – I didn't know who she was until she appeared on AEW. And she got a pretty good reaction, I thought. Not the biggest or anything, but definitely like – for where as many times as she's been on the show. Tony got a good pop when she came out. Taya Valkyrie, not that it was big, but she definitely got a better pop than I would have thought. But she also, they put on a good match, and I think that helped. Johnny Jacket is more over than he is. And that was apparent by the crowd, that they liked his jacket more than him. So,
oh, wow.
You know, and one group of people kept calling him and just – they were Johnny, Mundo, Elite. Like, it just kept jokingly going through all of his names. And, but he didn't react too crazy to it. He did acknowledge them. But, and then they got over the Johnny Jacket chant.
which I don't know if that made it on TV, but it was pretty funny.
There's also, they also chanted Don Callis, "Wear Your Socks." Did I hear that right?
He did. That was the same group of people who did "Wear Your Socks." And then my friend told me to be quiet because I started cheering "Let's Go Don" just to be contrarian. And he thought it would not end well because people hated him so much. But, yeah, that and the cardboard characters got over really big, which I don't know how much
yeah,
of that segment
that.
Was apparent. But that I found that segment to be weird because everyone was – I know I'm switching here, but was surprised that the Bullet Club came out. They just suddenly came out, and it was a nice surprise. But then Max Caster didn't even do his rap. The Acclaim just came out, and then Billy Gunn got a huge pop because of who he is, and he literally did the DX chant. Almost everyone in that arena probably grew up insane. So, but it was just very strange, and I'm watching Switchblade thinking, this was the guy who was leading New Japan? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
I mean, he's getting a pop.
I know.
He's one of six people right now. Like, this guy should be leading up, man. I was just baffled. Like, this guy can do so much more, and this is not nothing, but he's above this. This is perfect for Billy Gunn, you know, in the Gunn Club. This is great. And they claimed, I mean, they could do more, but I'm just, I cheered. I put the guns up, don't get me wrong, but I'm also thinking, I'm kind of doing it partially, hoping one day Switchblade gets the spot he's at. He's proven he can handle. Because I don't want him to get lost in the weeds. But, again, a fun segment that really made no sense. It didn't push any storyline forward at all. It was just like, hey, fans, aren't you having fun tonight? And we're like, yeah, we're having fun tonight. So it's very similar to local wrestling shows.
Mitch, talk about what happened off air with Tony Khan. Did he talk to the crowd once or twice? How did it go? What did you think of what he had to say?
He talked twice that I know of, and I think he was talking a third time as we were leaving. He was. That's what he announced, the BCC versus CMLL. I got the impression he really loves New Orleans because he said it eight times. and some people chanted pay-per-view. And he was like, maybe one day, I'm duly noted. And I'm like, that'd be nice, but, you know, I doubt it. But that would be nice to people. And he just said how thankful he was. I mean, he did come across as genuine, except for how much that he loved New Orleans. I know some people really love New Orleans, and maybe he's telling the truth, but it was getting a little, like, out of hand. But I do think overall it was genuine, and he really loves wrestling. And I do think he wanted everyone to have a good time. I think that's why some of these segments exist, because he says, listen to the crowd. They're having fun. Thank you guys for staying for Rampage. Thanks for having fun. So glad. You know, there's definitely this sense that AEW wants you to get your money's worth and enjoy your time there. I definitely got a sense of that, but it feels a little old school WWE of look how happy everyone is. And I'm like, well, we're happy, but I can't get my friends to watch this who don't watch wrestling, but I can say, you want to come over and watch WrestleMania? And they're like, yeah, sure. And it's just like, that's what I want for AEW. And what I saw tonight is not, that's not going to convince those people to go, but I had fun. You know, I'm not saying AEW is going anywhere. And if this is the spot they want to be in, then I think they can do a great job doing it. But this is going to be the spot with small arenas that are 2/3 full. Because, everybody who wants to go goes. The tickets are fairly priced. That's not a problem. You know, they charge relatively the same as WWE. So, I think, you know. But, yeah, Tony's good.
So,
I mean, I like Tony. I get the impression of that. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so my final specific question for you is just, can you run down what happened on Rampage? We are giving people a warning to fast forward 2 minutes.
Yeah, the first match of
spoiled,
Private
but,
Party and Dynamite.
You paid for the tapings? Pass along.
Yeah, I'm sorry, my phone cut out. I didn't know you were talking.
Sure, yeah. Go ahead with the rundown of what happened.
Yeah, so the Top Flight versus Private Party match is going to be, etc. exactly what you think it is. So if you want to watch a bunch of high spots and it's an entertaining match that kind of doesn't move a story too much, that was not a bad one. The Willow Queen of Monada match was, I mean, I didn't, it was too long. It was just too long. There was one more. I know there was one more for the main event, but I don't remember.
It was the CML Alcaraz versus the...
Yeah, the main event.
A group of sweeter faces.
Yeah, it was Christopher Daniels, Daddy Magic, Kool-Aid Hands, and Matt Sydal against all the CMLL guys. I think they're setting the CMLL guys up to feud with DCC. So it's not a bad match to watch. It also went a little long, but not a bad match. I mean, if you skip Rampage, you're not missing anything. The best match was definitely the tag title defense that I don't want to spoil for anybody. Because also Ricky Starks is from the New Orleans area. The city he's from is the suburb of New Orleans.
Yeah.
So he gets a big pop. He walked through the crowd at the end. I mean, he typically does, like I took a picture with him last time they were here. So he does, he interacts with the crowd and stuff. So he got a big pop, and that was kind of fun to watch. And the match itself was good. I mean, you know, I don't think it's going to be a shock to win. And, but it was a good match overall. But if you miss this Rampage, you're not, I mean, I think you're going to be just fine, with that in the BCC. I was surprised. It looked like Matthew and Nicholas were there, but they didn't come out. And I say that because my buddy Corey Constantine was the guy who got fined. So I texted him, like, did you just get fined $500? And he said, yeah, and they didn't even tell me where I got to pay. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Oh, funny.
So, yeah, that was funny. But, I just found it odd that, because Darby Allin comes out during the tag match to get on commentary. So, he was there, too. So I just found it weird. Like, why are they there, but they're not appearing? It just seems like an easy win. Like, they come out, they get booed, they get cheered, whatever. If they're there, I don't know. Why not come out? But not the end of the world.
Was there any response for the luchadors, the CMLL talent?
Yeah, people cheered them because they did have that Moxley introduction. Not just since they cheered, they reacted to them. But at first they reacted negatively, but then, I mean, it's a luchador match, and Moxley, it's not like the BCC are good guys, so beating, you know, getting up on them, I don't care. And most people don't care. I mean, I think, like, the BCC, Eddie Kingston, like, these guys are all, like, down for whatever. So whatever you do to them, they'll just do to you. So it doesn't matter. And I kind of get the vibe with this. Like, once they start doing high spots, it was all – everyone was cheering and oohing and aahing. And it was mainly one guy in particular who worked the majority of the match. His name's escaping me. I think it was Hichiro. He was the gold one. It wasn't Mystico or El Toro. But he did a pretty good job selling and stuff. He worked the majority of the match. And they got a decent reaction, I would say. I'm a little interested in what they're going to do with them. But
yeah. Jake, I'll throw to you one last time. Anything else you want to ask Mitch before we let him go?
No, I don't think so. I think you got everything. We're good.
Yeah. Mitch, great. Thanks for taking time to talk to us about your experience at the show tonight.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks, guys. Hope you have a good night.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, too. Drive safe. If you want to be an on-site correspondent, drop me a line, wadekellerpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll plan for that and set you up to be one. All right, let's close with just a quick rundown of a few emails here with some topics we haven't covered or just barely touched on. First, Chris from Tyler, Texas said, why would the Young Bucks mention getting Darby a new gimmick? It's absolutely impossible to immerse yourself in this world when the, quote, EVPs so intentionally take you out of it. As usual, I'm confused after an AEW show. Some decent segments, but more matches with predictable finishes and storylines that don't make sense. Just so many weird choices. The Bucks can't help Jake but be meta. I mean, they just can't help themselves. They can't just be okay with having a story, characters, feuds, narratives that fit within the confines of a simulated sport presented in a two-hour format on TV. And they always seem to be talking to someone other than the mainstream viewer that AEW is chasing, and I would argue losing. On top of that, philosophically, I just don't think you should refer to wrestlers as having gimmicks ever on television unless it's a shtick like Toni Storm, where Deonna Purrazzo goes, hey, you just took on a gimmick to try to get the crowds to react to you differently, or to lure Tony Khan into giving you more TV time. Or so, you know, even that I'd have some issues with, but when it's clearly like someone has added a shtick gimmick on top of what their grounded personality is. So, what do you say to Chris about that comment about Darby?
Yeah, that's probably the one aspect of that stage segment that really stood out as being wrong-headed. And I think it's more of the sort of being the elite-style humor, kind of bleeding its way onto the Dynamite or, you know, AEW television broadcasts, because that's the kind of stuff, you know, the inside jokes, the meta humor, the making fun of people's gimmicks, things like that, that permeated that show and was kind of the basis for its audience. And you could see, you know, over time, towards the end there were less than, 50,000 people regularly watching that show. And at one point, when, you know, we're talking about prior to all the original All In show and the height of, you know, the speculation about the founding of this company, they had millions of views on that show, semi-regularly, where, episodes would have a large audience. And so it's kind of the same thing happening as being the elite kind of trailed off in its popularity and relevance. The Young Bucks have kind of trailed off, and they continue to try to make that style of humor work on television. And I just don't think it's particularly effective. It certainly isn't attracting the kind of audience that AEW needs to claw back.
Yeah. Yep. All right. Jason B says, is Tony Khan even trying anymore? 1600 people pre wrestle picks in a 9K plus arena. Wardlow versus Commander? Really? And it was a competitive match? Why? Where's the Dynamite I used to love? The crowd seemed dead, I guess because only 1,600. Well, it's 2,200 by Showtime. But why watch? I guess Swerve is wrestling RVD and will probably be in a good match, but once a Swerve squash be better? Why does every match have to be close? You can miss two or three Dynamites and not miss anything. And another Tony Khan announcement. Who cares? It has lost its appeal. I'm glad I started watching WWE again. So a disgruntled AEW viewer there. Couple talking points. The Swerve being in a squash wouldn't have made sense because this was the dealer's choice or whatever, where Hangman got to pick an opponent for Swerve and Swerve got to pick an opponent for Hangman. Did you like that gimmick in the execution of it where the opponents – did it make sense that Hangman and Swerve would pick those opponents for them?
I guess. I mean, Toa Leona's part of the Mogul Embassy, so Swerve tapping him to soften up Hangman, I guess, makes some sense. Rob Van Dam and the hardcore stipulation, I guess I don't know how that aligns with the story that they're trying to tell, but it made for a memorable TV segment, and I think that took priority over having it fit and dovetail into the ongoing story. But I don't hate it. I mean, having the opponents, pick the match stipulation and a special opponent for their foe is fun if you execute it properly. I think they did a fine job of it here, but it's one of those things where both of them ended up being in longer matches with opponents you didn't really believe had any chance of defeating them. And so you're kind of walking that tightrope of, if the match kind of trails on too long and there's too many near falls, is it too competitive? Does it take something away from the person you're trying to frame as a star, versus having it be a squash, which doesn't really benefit anybody. So I think they, if you're looking at it as a spectrum, they probably were a little bit too close to the, this is too competitive, and it took away from some of the star power.
What about Tony Khan's big announcement? We got another one of those. They're loading the show up next week, and, TK making a big announcement does create some buzz and conversation online, and Tony Khan spends a lot of time online. So now people will be talking about AEW and talking about him and speculating about this. our emailer Jason says that it's lost its appeal. Has it, or is this good? If you're going to load up a Dynamite, why not go back to that, especially if there's some sort of good payoff?
Well, yeah, I hope it's a good payoff. I think there was a point where he was abusing the special announcement gimmick and delivering less than what people expected. I think there's been enough, you know, speculation around major free agents coming into the company that this will get people excited. But again, it's not something that is going to reach outside of the audience that was already sort of, more than likely going to be tuning in anyway. You know, I think the special attraction gimmick works on some, but it's not going to stretch outside of the audience who already, you know, has all the information required to be excited about AEW.
Yeah. All right. Next, we'll go to JB, who is a heartbroken Lions fan from Detroit. I feel for you, JB. Been there. I felt bad for your team. As a University of Michigan graduate and lifelong Lions fan, it's been bittersweet roller coaster of a 2024 already. One, it really annoyed me when Excalibur kept describing the rules as lax tonight in Mox's match with Jeff Hardy. What does lax exactly mean? How is it different from any other AEW match? Any quick comment on that, Jake?
I mean, it just kind of reeked of laziness. That's really all you can say about it.
Yeah. Two, does anyone care about CMLL-BCC feuding? As an avid follower of AEW, even I am loosely familiar with what this feud is about. Even I am loosely familiar. Okay. And the intensity of it definitely didn't register with me tonight. We commented on that earlier. I saw them, and it reminded me of when Vince McMahon in the 90s was getting beat by Nitro, and he's like, oh, we'll bring some luchadors in to compete with Ray and Juventud over on Nitro. And it's like, if you're going to do it, you really got to do it. And, I mean, I think a lot of more mainstream casual fans, again, who AEW needs in order to grow, are going to look and go, I don't have any connection to these people, and it's hard to keep track of them. And, you know, they might give AEW a chance to establish their personalities and how they're different than the other mass wrestlers. But that would be a change of pace for AEW. Number three, I did like Hangman's reference on Collision to Swerve having to wait the whole effing show to find out who his opponent would be on Dynamite, and then showing that promo tonight again. That's a nice Easter egg to the fans who can insinuate that as a hint of it being RVD, and it leaves a mystery open to more casual fans who might not be aware. My question is, how would Hangman know that Swerve's match was going on last in kayfabe? Yeah, I can live with that. That's more of a format sheet or ask Tony Khan. That doesn't jump out to me as an issue. Jake?
No, I guess it's, you know, ends up being convenient because you have the secret revealed in the main event segment, but I think that's something that you can easily forgive.
Number four, why is Tony Schiavone agreeing with Adam Cole about Wardlow making a good decision and joining the Undisputed Kingdom? Cole's making his case. It was kind of funny, Jake, it struck me tonight that Adam Cole is in the role that Vince McMahon wanted him to be in. He's basically a heel manager for a big, powerful wrestler. It was supposed to be Keith Lee in WWE as a heel, and here it's Wardlow. Any thoughts on that? I mean, I think you can make the case that it's a good career move for Wardlow if Schiavone just thinks he's kind of spinning his wheels, but I get where JB's coming from in the sense that, you know, Schiavone shouldn't be for anyone thinking Adam Cole is aligning with him is a good decision given Cole's actions.
Yeah, I wish they would have had Schiavone frame it differently than he did. You know, they were just talking about a lot of Wardlow's individual accomplishments of being a multi-time TNT champion and standing on his own successfully for as long as he did. And they were making the claim that he took a step backwards by joining up with Adam Cole and sort of being subservient to, you know, to his desires or whatever the case is. And I wish he would have, made a bit more reference to the history, you know, with all the other factions that Wardlow had already been a part of in a similar role. And they didn't dive enough into detail to make the audience aware of, you know, of the fact that Adam Cole, you know, may not actually have Wardlow's best interest at heart. He's just, you know, using him for his own ends. And for whatever reason, Wardlow has kind of fallen into the same trap over and over again. And that part of it wasn't explored. It was just kind of a very surface level conversation. I think it could, you know, lead to a little bit of a deeper, character analysis on Wardlow if they spend a bit more time on it than they did, and maybe we'll eventually get there. But I think it's one of those situations where they just gave you enough detail, you know, to pass as a casual conversation during commentary, where it could have been used a bit more effectively than it was.
All right. Has the Don Callis family advanced enough since its inception? It seems like it's either been absent or spinning its wheels for several months now, when it had the opportunity to be a hot faction. Much more potential than the Undisputed Kingdom, in my opinion. I agree. Also, what point should Jericho be putting the group over? I hope Takeshita gets the win over him next week. Yeah, I mean, every time I see Don Callis, I'm like, it feels like they're using him at 40% capacity. And he should, if they're going to have him around, he and his faction should be a centerpiece act, not just one of a dozen equal feuds that right now Chris Jericho happens to be feuding with. And Takeshita has really lost momentum when he could have been in a much better spot by now. Those are my thoughts. Jake, how about yours?
Yeah, I really don't get what the purpose of the Don Callis family is at this point. It's just kind of a safety net for wrestlers who don't have anywhere else to be at this point. You know, they had a lot of promise. Powerhouse Hobbs defeated Chris Jericho, you know, in a dominant fashion. You know, you've had Takeshita, you know, he comes out of hiding every once in a while to beat a major star, whether it's Kenny Omega or Darby Allin or whomever. And then they just both go back into hiding, standing behind Don Callis while he, you know, he rants about whoever he's in a feud with. And I think there is a lot of promise in, you know, in Callis and his faction, but it doesn't seem like the follow-up is there whenever they give them a big moment. And I think that's a problem for a lot of people who you'd classify as being in AEW's mid-card. You know, they put them on TV, they give them a spotlight in a big moment, and then there's just a lack of follow-up. So I think consistency is the biggest issue with Takeshita and the Don Callis family right now.
Yep, agreed. All right, I don't think – this is still JB. I don't think I'm going out on a limb when I say that the Bang Bang Scissors gang is an example of the sum of the pieces being greater than the whole for almost every single member. The goofiness is doing irreparable harm to Jay White and arguably even the futures of Caster and Bowens. I agree. I've had my fill of the Billy Gunn Nostalgic Tour. I think Bowens and Caster as a tag team are way diminished compared to where they were a year or two ago. I think they both have singles potential or potential in a kind of a fresh, different mix if one of them goes into a tag team and the other becomes singles. And Jay White, of course, it's a given. I mean, he should have been protected and framed as a centerpiece single star, and he's not. I've been an advocate for Colton Gunn being somebody who maybe eventually breaks away and has a singles run. I think there's a certain presence to him. I think Austin's a bit of a goof, and entertainingly so, kind of in a Juice Robinson way. But to me, Colton is someone I keep an eye on, along with even Max Caster to a degree, as potential single stars because of the personality and you know, size that works in the main event sphere of AEW. And yeah, they just all, it feels weird and inefficient in terms of flying all these guys in for stuff like this. I mean, obviously they have something they're working towards storyline wise, and maybe all's well that ends well. Jake, anything more you want to add on that?
No, I mean, I think you touched on all the big points there, but Jay White is the one who feels like he's been squandered the most. You know, he came into the company with, you know, having had a fantastic run in New Japan and felt like a main event level guy, and has, you know, a charisma and a personality about him, particularly when he's really been able to cut loose on the microphone. And it feels like they've sort of, you know, they've wasted that. They have a long rebuild process in front of them if they want Jay White to be seen as a main event player again at some point.
I agree. Finally, I actually really liked the Serious Darby and Sting tonight. It felt like two guys ready and raring for a few important fights on the horizon. I thought those were the highlights of the show. Both Darby and Sting were good. Sting actually had something to say. I liked the segment. I thought it was well done. I thought Starks and Bill were good in their roles too. Jake?
Yeah, I'm in complete agreement there. I thought it was in terms of, you know, building something for next week's show. It set the stage for what feels like an important match. You got it feels like it's unpredictable in the sense that you're not 100% certain who's going to come away with the win, and they built a good bit of animosity between the two teams. You feel like you know where everybody stands at this point, and now you're ready for the showdown match. So yeah, I think they did a great job.
All right, final email. This is Zach in Texas. Tonight was good, but next week is shaping up to be huge. I enjoyed the sit-down interview with Sting and Darby and Ricky and Bill. I'm genuinely excited to see Sting raise a title over his head. I just hope the Young Bucks don't get involved, at least until after the match. They ominously said they needed another way to get Darby's attention, and that worries me. What doesn't worry me is how great Swerve and Hangman 3 is going to be. I'm a little surprised they didn't go with the Hell of War stipulations, but either way, these guys aren't going to wear each other out. I'm ecstatic that they're going to payoff of sorts next week, and it's going to be a one-on-one match at Revolution, but I don't know which way they're going to go. Will Hang Magnum finally get his win, or will Swerve go 3-for-3? I like not knowing. I tend to lean towards Swerve winning and Paige going off the rails as a result. And then there's Tony Khan's latest big announcement. I hope it's a signing of Okada. I know it'll break Wade's heart, but AEW is a better fit for a top-three wrestler on planet Earth like Okada, who's built his career on having the highest quality matches. As always with Zach, a spirited AEW positive-leaning email with a out-of-context, unfair framing of something that I had said in the past, but it's a tradition. To be clear, I have been torn between the pros and cons of AEW and WWE, and talking with Greg yesterday on the flagship, I lean to WWE because I just think there's more novel matches, and I'm real curious what Paul Levesque would do with Okada, because I think he'd appreciate him and want to figure out a way to portray him at a top level, and turn him into a big star. And so just from the chair I sit in, literally as a commentator and analyst and journalist covering wrestling, that intrigues me more than just more good Okada matches with him sort of being dropped in to AEW the way other good wrestlers are dropped in. And I'm a little concerned about the inconsistency of how Takeshi's been pushed, or for that matter, you know, things we've said about other wrestlers on the show, like Jay White coming from New Japan. Jake, how do you feel about Okada and the pros and cons of AEW versus WWE? Where are you on this?
I mean, selfishly, much like you, I think there's more novelty in him going to WWE because there's more fresh matchups for him there. He's already competed at a high level with a lot of the top stars in AEW. For that reason, I think I'd like to see him in WWE. But I think it really, it boils down to, I think AEW might offer him a lot more flexibility when it comes to, remaining living in Japan and relaxing how many dates he has to show up for and things of that nature. But it's hard not to want to see him on a big stage with the big, the big presentation that I imagine that WWE would want to put together for a wrestler of his caliber. But I guess I'm not opposed to either one. I think it could work either way. But I think we'd be seeing Okada having, top level matches with people we've already seen him have top level matches with if he jumps over to AEW. But I think this is really about him, coming over to the United States and making, the kind of money that he's been missing out on being in Japan for the last several years and the week yen and everything else that goes along with it.
Very good. Anything else on what Zach had to say, like Swerve Hangman 3? I like his idea that Swerve gets a third win and that's what causes Hangman to snap.
Yeah, I think that's one of the stronger booking options. I do think that there's a possibility that we could see the three-way emerge if there's some kind of non-finish. But I like it. I think that's what Hangman needs right now is a big push in a particular direction from a character standpoint, because as much as I've enjoyed his feud with Swerve and what they've been doing with him over the last couple of months, it just kind of feels like he's been in limbo on the part of the way too. So yeah. I'm all for that, but I think it's it's really a decision about how they want to frame Samoa Joe's title reign and if they're planning on pulling the trigger on Swerve here in a couple of weeks.
Very good. Jake, anything else from Dynamite you want to bring up before we sign up?
No, that should do it. Thank you very much.
Great. Yeah, thank you. I was thinking after watching Dynamite that we'll probably keep it at an hour, 10 minutes. And look at that. Callers, on-site correspondent, emails, our conversation. And we've pushed way past that. Fun conversation. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And I will talk to you Friday night after SmackDown. In the meantime, if you haven't yet, check out the flagship. Greg Parks joined me, and we talked for a while about all the top topics of a very, very busy and controversial week, including the CM Punk injury, the Vince McMahon lawsuit, some on the Netflix deal, and Samoa Joe as champion and more. So check that out. If you haven't yet, search Wade Keller in your podcast app and subscribe to the Red and Blue Logo Show, and then search PW Torch and subscribe to the Daily Cast for other shows with different hosts and different themes, including the AEW Conversation Club that drops late each week. And it is a new show on our feed and definitely worth checking out. All right, thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to y'all next time.